From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, a billion people watch the World Cup, but is there a future for women's soccer on TV? Then Lulu Wang's movie The Farewell centers on a Chinese-American woman, and parts of it are in Mandarin. In trying to get the film made, Wang repeatedly had to explain it is not a foreign film.
It's not the type of American lead that we're used to, but that's part of it, you know? People need to get used to these faces as being part of the faces of America.
And we remember the creator of the bossa nova, Joao Gilberto. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Let's start today with some instant replay, the radio version at least, and revisit Rose Lavelle's amazing goal in the Women's World Cup yesterday.
Lavelle, Rose up the middle, looking, cutting, shooting, goal!
That was the second score for the U.S. team, giving them a 2-0 lead against the Netherlands. The Americans won Sunday's game by that score, and the match could also be considered a win for women's soccer overall because of the number of people who tuned in to watch. The tournament attracted more than 1 billion total viewers around the globe. For more on the numbers and what they could mean for the fight to get equal attention for professional female athletes, we called up Ben Strauss. He covers sports and media for The Washington Post. And I started by asking him about how big of an increase in viewership there was from the last Women's World Cup 4 years ago.
Domestically, you had about a 1% increase from 2015, I should say. And so while that doesn't seem like a very big deal, those games were played mostly in prime time. The tournament was in Canada, and so you've got your prime time East Coast American audiences. And so to match the viewership 4 years later, when the games are being played at 11 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the afternoon sometimes, because they're in France, that's notable. Perhaps even more notable, though, is some of the numbers that have come in around the world, a billion worldwide viewers. That's a 25% increase from 4 years ago, and about 80% of the TVs that were on yesterday in the Netherlands were watching the final.
The other thing that struck me is that the regional audience in the United States was huge. Some of the top markets were cities like Austin, Kansas City, Portland, Boston. It felt like all of the nation was watching. And I wonder how much of that was tied to the fact, too, that a lot of the play-in games and the elimination games were on broadcast, I think almost double the amount from the World Cup 4 years ago.
Yes. So part of the story of increased viewership is the availability of these games. Fox put 22 of the group stage games on Fox on broadcast TV versus Fox Sports 1, which is their cable network. And then it's sort of an if you build it, they will come type of situation where you treat it, you know, the exact same as a men's tournament, and you put it on free over-the-air TV and you get these ballooning numbers.
One of the things that I think really proves how a lot of people still don't take women's soccer seriously is that there were two other huge soccer matches for men scheduled on the same day as the Women's World Cup final. And that was set a long time ago, so it wasn't like this was a surprise. The Gold Cup, where the American men, who we should note, did not qualify for the World Cup, lost to Mexico 1-0, and the Copa America, where Brazil beat Peru 3-0. What does that say about how the soccer audience and people who are programming soccer games look at the Women's World Cup in terms of competition?
Yeah, I think when you think about how FIFA has treated women's soccer, it's taken the organization a really long time to rise to the occasion. When you look at the pay dispute, the pay equity issues between the U.S. men's team and the U.S. women's team, a large part of it is the payouts from the FIFA World Cup.
We're talking with Ben Strauss at the Washington Post about the numbers for the Women's World Cup. I'll cite one other number. The total prize money for the Women's World Cup this year was $30 million. In the 2018 Men's World Cup, the total prize pool was about $400 million. But I think there's more to this story than just pay. I want to play a clip from Megan Rapinoe before the World Cup talking on ABC's Good Morning America about some of the other issues.
In order to have, I think, a fair and a balanced conversation around compensation, we need to look at everything. We need to look at the way the youth teams are funded. We need to look at the way our staff, our coaching staff, our medical staff is funded. We need to look at promotion and branding and marketing and sponsorship, all of that. And until we do, until we have equity and equality of the men's and women's team on both those sides, we can't really say, oh, the men make this and the women make this.
I want to ask you more about what Megan Rapinoe said, that whole idea about kind of marketing and promotion, and that is about advertising dollars, what role they can play, what advertisers can do, and how that might translate into more attention for the sport and more money for women players.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think, you know, just recently, you could look at what Visa did, and they signed a big deal with U.S. Soccer, you know, sponsorship deal, and very specifically stipulated that half of those funds needed to be spent on women's program, and, you know, both pay, but also a lot of those issues that Megan Rapinoe spoke about in that clip. And the interest from advertisers, I'll sort of talk about too. 4 years ago, you know, as late in the tournament as the round of 16, the quarterfinals, Fox was still selling ads on a game-by-game basis. This time around, you know, almost all the inventory was sold out ahead of time, and, you know, the 30-second ad rates really jumped up.
I'm sure there are tens of thousands of young girls and probably a lot of boys who are out in their backyards right now practicing their soccer moves because they were so inspired by what happened over the weekend. But I'm wondering about the sport itself and about soccer. How can soccer and how can broadcasters and cable companies keep this momentum moving forward? And what does the future for women's soccer look like?
You know, I feel like we have this conversation every 4 years around the men's game, and I guess we have it more often now with the women's game.
Yeah, the American women are better, though.
We have the Women's Soccer League, the North American Women's Soccer League, and they just signed in the last few days a deal with ESPN to put 14 games for the rest of the season on both ESPN News and ESPN2, and this is, you know, a big step up in exposure for that league. You know, a lot of these players are playing for teams in Orlando and Washington, D.C., in the North American Women's Soccer League. They are there, and if this is important to you as a consumer, they need more help in between the World Cups.
Ben Strauss covers sports and media for The Washington Post. Ben, thanks for taking time and coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Coming up on The Frame, how writer and director Lulu Wang turned her family story for This American Life into a feature film. The new film, The Farewell, is based on writer-director Lulu Wang's own stranger-than-fiction real-life family story. But instead of opening with the familiar title card that reads, based on a true story, Wang's film begins with this message, based on an actual lie. Rapper and actress Awkwafina plays a Chinese-born, U.S.-raised young woman who is told that her beloved grandmother has only weeks to live. Although pretty much everyone in the family knows the dire prognosis, they've all decided not to tell the matriarch herself. As a ploy to get all the relatives back to China to see the grandmother before she dies, the family quickly throws together a wedding. I spoke with Lulu Wang back in January at the Sundance Film Festival, where The Farewell premiered, and we started off talking about the decision to start the film with that opening text.
We wanted people to know that this was based on actual events that were happening, but we wanted it to be funny at the same time. Just, you know, I think when you enter a film and you get a laugh right off the bat, that sets the tone for the film.
So even though this story is very personal to you, did writing it and directing it and cutting it and even maybe showing it to audiences change the way you saw your own past?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, first I did a story for This American Life. So throughout that process was the first stage of interviewing my parents and my little Nainai, which is my great aunt. And I learned a lot through them. And then in making the movie, you know, people have come up and said, oh, I heard you're This American Life. I hear you're making a film. You know, that same thing happened to my family. And they're not even Chinese. They're, you know, from Brazil or Iran. And it was just incredible to see how many people related to this really bizarre situation.
What's wrong, Dad? Please tell me.
Minan is dying.
She doesn't know, so you can't say anything. The family thinks it's better not to tell her.
Why is that better?
Chinese people have saying, when people get cancer, they die.
So for people who don't understand the motivation of why you would withhold information like that, what is the idea behind not telling somebody that they're actually gravely ill?
The way it was explained to me is that when people have cancer, it's not the cancer that kills them first. It's often the fear. And so at least from an Eastern perspective, there's a lot of emphasis on mind and body connection. For example, one of the things I learned throughout this process is, you know, what if this person has a celebration? What if it's their birthday? What if, you know, their son or grandchild is gonna have a wedding or something like that? The family would be able to discern a better time to tell them, whether it's later or not at all in this situation. And it even goes so far as to say, well, obviously, you know, you never want to give somebody bad news at night because it's dark, there's no light, and they have to go to sleep, and they're not going to be able to sleep. And the lack of sleep causes even more depression. And so it's this like cycle. So you give it to them first thing in the morning, you know, lots of light, you plan a day of activity, and it gives them the time to process. And to me, that was like so thoughtful in such a kind way that I had never thought about before.
A lot of movies have very odd paths to the screen. Yours had an unusual path. I want to ask you about when you first wanted to tell this story, in what format, and the path it took to get to where it is today as a feature film.
Yeah, when this first happened to me, I knew there was something about the story that just, I knew I had to tell it. You know, I've never felt such an urgency to tell a story, and so much so that when I came home, I just like would dream of like these scenes that were happening, and they were haunting me, and I would just write it down on paper. And you know, it seemed impossible to get anyone to finance the film that I wanted to make, the version of the story that I wanted to make and the way I wanted to make it with authentic casting, authentic language. So I set it aside and just didn't think I would ever make it as a film and got really sad about it. And it made a short film, went to film festivals, and a producer from This American Life came to me and said, do you have any other stories? I really like your voice. And I was like, well, actually, I kind of did like a first draft of a short story that I wanted to make as a film, but take a look. He loved it. His name is Neil Drumming, and he took it to This American Life and set it up there. And, you know, it took a month to tell the story on This American Life between writing it and narrating it and editing it. And the process was so seamless and so wonderful and so pure that I was very depressed afterwards because I thought, you know, I'm never going to have this feeling again because I work as a filmmaker. And it sort of made me question my entire career choices. And so it's just pretty incredible that now I'm here and got to make this film.
So just so I understand, you were depressed because you saw that you had this great story that you could tell and that you did tell. And that felt like the end of the story as opposed to what you wanted to do, which is make it into a film?
Yeah, I was depressed because the purity of doing the radio story is something I had never experienced in my work previously. And it gave me a new outlook on how I could approach my work and the type of freedom and the type of support and the type of encouragement of like figuring out my voice as opposed to saying, what does this need to be before even developing the story? And I think that was the hindrance to the film because before we even explored the nuances of these scenes and the characters, it was about set pieces and how do we market this and who's going to watch this kind of film. And so it just sort of halted the entire creative process. Whereas with This American Life, you have these brilliant storytellers and producers helping to guide me to really present my voice. And I think that that's what allowed producers in Hollywood to see that this could be a film.
We're talking with Lulu Wang about her movie, The Farewell. The character that is inspired on Your Own Life is played by Awkwafina, who is really great in the film. Awkwafina's an actor, and she needs to find what she has to find for her to play this character. And you have to find what it is that she needs that is her own and not yours. Mm-hmm. So how do you negotiate with her about what she feels this character is when the character is based on the life of the person who is writing and directing the movie, and that's you.
Yeah, we talked a lot about it where I said, you know, I'm not looking to cast or to direct an actor to play me. I am looking to create a sympathetic character who is, it's more about her inner journey and her inner struggle. And as long as the actor can connect with that struggle, I think that's what holds the film together. And for Awkwafina, she was raised by her Chinese grandmother. And, you know, she's getting older. And so the very thought of losing her grandmother just would make her burst into tears. And I said, bring that. Bring that to every single scene, whether it's a funny scene, whether it's a sad scene. All you are thinking about is that you are going to lose your grandmother. And so I think that poignancy is something she definitely brought to the movie.
Billy, who is the character played by Awkwafina, is applying for and having difficulty landing a fellowship. I think it's a Guggenheim fellowship. And I'm watching the movie and I'm thinking, is this like somebody trying to get financing for a movie? Is that what that is? Is that like a stand-in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, and I hope so many of us can relate to this struggle when you're trying to do something that you're passionate about and also do something that you feel is worthy of your parents' sacrifice. If you're the child of immigrants, I think that is the greatest challenge to overcome, is how do you find your voice amidst, first of all the noise of the industry, and then on top of that, your parents saying, how can you do this? They don't see the representation. And so then they think, are operating out of fear, and you have your own fears. And so to battle the fear of your family is very different for an immigrant child because of all of the sacrifice that you've literally witnessed your family going through in order for you to have a better life. And so you feel like by pursuing your passions, you are actually torturing your family. And so I think that's the greatest challenge to so many people of color and immigrants who are not getting their voices out, I think, is beyond just the industry.
Every filmmaker who comes to Sundance or any film festival has gone on a long journey bringing his or her movie into life and then bringing it here. But that's not always the end of the journey. The journey also requires that people beyond Park City, Utah get to see the film. And you're now at that period where your film has shown and you're trying to figure out, or people who you work with are trying to figure out how you can get it distributed and released. What is that period like for you?
The way that you present a film to the world is just as important as how you make the film. I mean, so many wonderful films, unfortunately, don't get seen. And yeah, and I think this film, because there's the Mandarin language and its subtitles, and in America, that seems to be a challenge for some people. And yet people who've seen the film say it's not a challenge. So how do you bridge that gap? You know, how do we convince people that, yes, you have to read some subtitles, but pretty quickly into the film, you don't even realize that you're reading. And so many people have said that to me, because there's English in the film as well, where they're like, you know, you don't realize when you're reading and when you're hearing English, it just all becomes one. And that's important, because that's part of the experience of being an immigrant. And that is my life, where, you know, I'm speaking in Chinese and English and hearing all of these things. And sometimes there's a miscommunication, but that's all part of the beauty of it.
At the premiere screening of your film at the Sundance Film Festival, in the audience were your parents. And I wonder, A, had they seen the movie before? B, what it was like to show it to them? Because they're very much big characters in the film.
Yeah, you know, my parents had not seen the movie before this. I intentionally did that because they tend to be very judgmental, particularly my mother, on everything. And, you know, with this film being so personal and based on them, I was worried that they would, you know, influence too much of my process. And so they saw it for the first time at the Eccles in a totally packed house. And afterwards, my mother turned to my boyfriend and my brother and said, I'm nothing like that woman, am I? She's so mean. And my boyfriend was like, no, you're much sweeter. And my brother Anthony was like, no, that's exactly you.
That's a good boyfriend and yep. An honest brother.
Yes.
Lulu, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Lulu Wang wrote and directed The Farewell. It's in theaters on July 12th. Coming up on The Frame, we bid a fond farewell to a Brazilian music legend, João Gilberto. He died this weekend at the age of 88. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Here's some of what you can look forward to this week on our show. Piano duos are pretty rare, and even more rare is a duo composed of two sisters. You'll hear my conversation with Katya and Muriel Labeck, and comedian and actor Kumail Nanjiani stars in the new film Stuber. You'll hear why he thinks this mismatched buddy comedy is different from all the others. And now, João Gilberto. The Brazilian musician credited with creating the bossa nova sound died on Saturday in Rio de Janeiro at the age of 88. In the early 1960s, Gilberto introduced a new way of singing and playing the guitar, ushering in a musical revolution. His collaboration with American saxophonist Stan Getz yielded a best-selling album and introduced bossa nova to a huge audience, largely through the song The Girl from Ipanema. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos offers an appreciation.
João Gilberto was born on June 10, 1931, in the northeastern state of Bahia. By the time he was 18, he was a crooner on a radio station in Salvador, the state capital. He moved to Rio in 1950, but several years later he left Rio to work on his guitar playing and vocal style, away from the music scene. That story is recounted in a conversation between singers David Byrne, Brazil's Tom Zé, and guitarist Arthur Lindsay, released in 2010 as part of Tom Zé's vinyl box set.
The story goes that when João understood the possibilities of the microphone, that he left Rio, where he was already trying to make a career as part of these vocal quartets that were very popular at the time.
That's guitarist Arthur Lindsay. Translating the story told by Tom Zé, Lindsay says Gilberto moved back to his hometown to develop his unique approach to music making.
Went back to Juazeiro, where he was from, and just woodshedded for a year, lived with his sister or something. And he went to Juazeiro, and he also went to Minas, to his sister's house, and he would sit in her bathroom, I know the story, all day. You know, the whole family's like running around, da-da-da-da-da, and he's sitting there in the bathroom because the sound is so nice. Mm-hmm. For weeks and months on end, you know, coming up with a style, you know, to fit this new possibility.
Gilberto delivered that new possibility after returning to Rio. In March of 1959, he released Chega de Saudade, an album that would forever change the sound and direction of Brazilian music. With the simplicity of his guitar playing, he turned Brazil's most popular genre, samba, into a highly sophisticated music style, which came to be known as bossa nova, or the new wave. Next came his landmark collaboration with American saxophonist Stan Getz in the early 60s, featuring pianist Antonio Carlos Jobim, another major creator of the bossa nova sound, and João Gilberto's then-wife, Astro Gilberto, singing the English lyrics of one of the most popular tunes of the genre, The Girl from Ipanema. From the mid-60s until 1979, Gilberto lived in New York. Between 1969 and 1971, he also lived in Mexico City, where he recorded João Gilberto en México. The album included a couple of Mexican ballads, such as the classic Bésame Mucho, transformed by his singular style. Bésame mucho. A longtime admirer of Gilberto is singer Caetano Veloso. Veloso wrote extensively about Gilberto's impact on Brazilian popular music in his 1997 book, Tropical Truth. He also produced what would become Gilberto's last studio album, João, Voz e Violão. The album won a Grammy Award in 2001. It included the song that put Gilberto and Bossa Nova on the world map, only this time pared down to guitar and voice, like the title of the album. Following the release of that album, Gilberto and Veloso performed a concert together in Buenos Aires, singing each other's songs. Here's Gilberto playing guitar and singing one of his signature songs, Desafinado, followed by Veloso. Over the weekend, Veloso wrote a touching eulogy to Gilberto on his Instagram account. With his voice and guitar, he remade the function of speech and the history of the instrument. He put into perspective every book I've ever read, all the poems, every picture, every movie I've ever seen, not just every song I've heard. And it was with his lens, this filter, this sound system, that I went to read, see, and hear. In Veloso's 1997 album Libro, the last song is called Pra Ninguém, For No One. In it, Veloso lists 20 popular Brazilian singers of the 20th century and some of their hits. At the end of the song, Veloso wrote these verses. Better than this, there's only silence. Better than silence, only João. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos. Se você disser
que eu desafino, amor. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn in the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll be back here tomorrow. Só privilegiados têm ouvido igual ao seu.